Welcome to KABU, Rachel Greenwald Smith.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, in addition to your teaching at St. Louis University and a previous book on the literary establishment in the age of neoliberalism, you've written a number of essays on politics and popular culture. This new book on compromise, art, politics, and the fate of an American ideal is a sort of hybrid work, part memoir, part cultural commentary, part philosophical critique. And we learn in this beautifully written and lively book some about your background as a guitar player in New York City and in our all-girl punk band, a bit of your history that alone is worth the read. So let's start today with the opening and ending scenes of the book. In the book's opening, you describe your reactions to a protest refrain at a women's march where you are participating, and the anthem, "This is what democracy looks like," an anthem that many of us are familiar with over the years of protest. And you point out that democracy is messy and it requires comfort with tensions and compromises. And you end the book with this same refrain that this is what democracy looks like. Can you say something about how you're using that anthem that we're so familiar with, who those of us who've been part of protest events?
Sure. The anthem comes in early in the book at the 2017 Women's March in Washington, D.C., that of course took place right after the aftermath of the 2016 election. And in that scene, I'm in the place where I have to be saying this is what democracy looks like in response to a chant leader, because I'm in this march but feeling ambivalent about it. For two reasons. One is that kind of hilariously, I'm chanting, "This is what democracy looks like," as the group of people I'm in is walking in the wrong direction without any sort of guidance as to where to go. So I reflect a little bit on how the sort of loose populist form of democracy can turn into just total chaos without any sort of direction. But on the other hand, I also find myself in that moment skeptical of that chant, because it initiates a process of thinking about some of the problems with how we might think about compromise politically today. So while in that moment, I'm kind of both disturbed and charmed by the sort of messiness of activist politics and sort of populist democracy, I'm also thinking about the invocation of compromise in more formal politics by centrist politicians who are asking for compromise as a solution to what they imagine to be a problem with overpolarization in the United States.
Well, let's talk about that in a moment, but I'd like to stay with the discussion of the Women's March. It's very, sure. It's a wonderful to read your commentary and how much I resonated with many of your observations. But you confess to a pleasure in being part of the march, but also have a kind of critique of the Women's March, but it's not fully developed. And could you say a little bit about that, the ambivalence you express, you know, as a feminist as well as a scholar? What are you trying to say there?
Sure. So on the one hand, my experience of actually being at the Women's March was one that was unlike maybe what I expected. I went there feeling ambivalently about the march, feeling that I had to be there in some sense because I was so angry about what was happening and so badly wanted to be involved in any sort of political response to it. I'd also been invited to go to Washington, D.C. to stay with friends who I very much wanted to see and missed terribly. So I had a personal reason for being there. At the same time, I had been concerned when the march was first when the idea of the march was first raised, by some of the hiccups that happened in the early planning, where it seemed that there wasn't enough intersectional representation in the planning group. That was happily rectified. But the march to me still had a sort of general association with a kind of more mainstream white feminist a take that I think manifested later in the narrative of the march as being sort of a lot of people who celebrate, who supported Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. And I voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, but I did so despite the fact that I had vowed to never vote for her after her vote on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq right after September 11th. Of course, those are coming back to haunt us now. And so I felt the march embodied a kind of contradiction that I see sort of throughout the book, actually, in a lot of the political examples, between, on the one hand, when I was actually there, feeling like it was a space of complexity, of dissent, of many different people from many different perspectives, of maybe some of the very best of coalition-based politics. But on the other hand, sometimes those things felt as if they were being erased toward a general narrative of kind of a more centrist agenda. And that made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, in a sense, it's inevitable, and it's not simply girls can't get along or squabbles among women, but there's a long history of feminist politics spanning liberal feminism of the Hillary Clinton version and corporate aspirations of feminists versus cultural feminist, socialist, Marxist feminist, Black feminist thought has brought a lot into the recent Black Lives Matter movement, as well as other aspects of feminism. And so it's not surprising that the march was kind of dominated with the visual presence of liberal feminism. But I think that gets that obscures all of the complex and interesting, important history of feminism. So there's like polarization there as well, and in a sense good, in a good sense. And you debunk this idea that polarization is a bad thing, that it's a pathology of our very contemporary post-Trump politics. And I think it'd be interesting to take up the way you use that line of critique in the chapter on the Missouri Compromise, which is a wonderful and very clever entree into your broad theme of uncompromise. Can you talk about that, the Missouri Compromise, as you relate it to racial politics and the history of liberalism?
Sure. So that chapter takes place. I should back up and say that most of the essays in this book do sort of move back and forth between the personal and the sort of critical political and aesthetic work that I'm doing. And that essay in particular is set in my hometown, which is St. Louis, Missouri. And it begins with the protests in Ferguson that followed the murder of Michael Brown in 2014. And thinks about the history of the Missouri Compromise and its legacy, both in Missouri and nationally. One of the first observations that for me gave rise to that chapter that I think is actually fairly startling, and I think we rarely think about this, is that for those of us who took sort of a basic U.S. history course at some point in our lives, whether that was in junior high or high school or college, we learn a series of compromises in U.S. history, beginning with the Three-Fifths Compromise and the U.S. Constitution, moving through the Missouri Compromise of 1820, and culminating maybe in the Compromise of 1877. In each of those compromises, essentially what happened was that the concerns of Black Americans, either as enslaved people, in the case of the Three-Fifths Compromise and the Missouri Compromise, or as people living under Reconstruction in the South in the context of the 1877 compromise, that Black Americans' concerns were essentially traded away for white peace. And the fact that the word compromises that occurs in U.S. history has been, I think, used in many ways to erase that violence and to see these progressive selling outs, essentially, of Black concerns as somehow being carrying the sort of positive valence of compromise. I think it's a manifestation of the way compromise in general can be used. The concept of compromise in general can be used to blanket over very important tensions and to justify the abdication of justice socially. So that's where that chapter starts. And then it kind of moves through both the history of St. Louis and political theoretical concerns about liberalism to think about what gets lost when we value compromise, especially around issues of race.
I think part of what's so instructive about that chapter is how what you call the virtue of compromise under liberalism, being a reasonable person, meeting someone in the middle, leaves out and represses so much of the history of marginalized and oppressed groups, that that's what's compromised rather than a general willingness to be rational.
That's absolutely right. And because that dispositional argument gets made about compromise, you know, this idea that people who compromise have better dispositions than those who are more extreme or those who are not willing to compromise, but that idea about the dispositional goodness of the compromiser causes all sorts of problems in our ability to see where justice is being served and when injustice is being tacitly consented to.
You also take up toward the end of the book some works and through literary works and some of your own history, the how we think about good people and bad people, these moral distinctions between extremists and those who are more rational, willing to compromise, and other ways of framing alliances and political enemies. Would you want to say something about that? Because that's a very big topic. And I think you open up questions, as in any good book, you open up questions that you can't possibly answer within the confines of the text. But in before we close, I would like to hear more of your thoughts on that, particularly as the charged political landscape of the country is characterized by so many pundits as a result of polarization and refusal to compromise. How you would cast the current or assess the current landscape through the lens of your book?
Thank you for that question. I think it's a really important one. So to begin, I guess, I think I make a distinction in the book between polarization and partisanship. And this isn't my distinction. This is a distinction that many people in political science and political theory have been working out for quite some time. But polarization more generally is, I think of as disagreements between groups of people about politics. Whereas partisanship has to do with an identification with a certain team or a certain type of person. And so one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is think about how polarization can actually be very healthy for a democracy. And in fact, how the tendency to value compromise on the left, beginning especially in the 1990s with the Clinton administration, and then running up through the present, has led to sort of depoliticization on the left until maybe 2016 or so, when the left became much more vocal and much more comfortable with a certain kind of extremity again, perhaps. But that period of time between the 1990s and 2016, the left really lost a lot of energy as a result of its antipathy toward polarization and its desire for compromise, I think, especially dispositionally. And that has partly given rise to the cultural climate that we see today, which I would characterize as a cultural climate of partisanship, in which people on the left and people on the right have gone further than just disagreeing with one another and toward hating one another. There's a whole set of theorists in political theory, people like Chantal Mouffe, for instance, who argue that it's precisely lack of opportunities for real political disagreement that lead people to replace politics with morality and start to think of one another as bad people. So in that climate, I mean, we're in a very difficult place now, you know, obviously as a country, but I think within that, given that situation, it's really dangerous now to think that compromising can be a solution to the problems that we're encountering in terms of partisanship. And instead, I would say that we need as much robust debate as possible. We need a left that's really willing to stake strong claims and defend ground. And we may need to think of the right as a force to try to defeat rather than to try to compromise with.
Well, that's a fitting ending to our discussion today, which I'd love to return to down the road. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Rachel Greenwald Smith about her new book on compromise, art, politics, and the fate of an American ideal. There'll be a post on our website for those who want to get the book. It's a fascinating and fun read, as well as full of incredible insights. Congratulations on your book, Rachel, and thanks for being with us today.